Session number 5399, Mr. H. Turner, one reel. The original reel 2 has been joined and begins approximately 29:35 with the words, "To my surprise."
The events recorded on this tape is an eyewitness account of an action that took place on the Western Front in 1918. I was a teenage soldier at the time, serving with the Machine Gun Corps. This recording is made more than 50 years after the experience, yet so vivid are my recollections of that period that I can remember in detail much of what took place at that time. In particular, the heavy German attack on the Scheminde Dams on the morning of the 27th of May, 1918. And as a prisoner of war afterwards, working behind the German front line. This recording is by ex-private 128025 H. Turner, D Company, 50th Divisional Battalion Machine Gun Corps. Prisoner of war number 302739. About the beginning of May in 1918, the Allied armies were regrouping after suffering heavy losses from the mass German attacks of March and April. In 40 days, our casualties amounted to some 239,000 men. In the Somme battles of 1916, our losses reached a staggering total of 416,000 men in 141 days. German losses were equally heavy, and one wondered how long this carnage could go on. Early in May, my division was moved to the Scheminde Dams. There, we were to be rested and to recuperate on this supposedly quiet sector of the front. And so it appeared to be when we arrived there. Our positions were on the California Plateau. The hillside leading to the summit was honeycombed with hideouts and tunnels, dug out by the French, who had previously occupied these positions. Early in the war, the Scheminde Dams had been lost to the Germans, but was later retaken by the French at a terrific cost in lives. When we arrived here, we took over the central position on the plateau, right on top of the hump. The right and left flanks were manned by French troops. Our first 3 weeks here were decidedly quiet, with only spasmodic artillery fire from either side. But on or about the 24th of May, we had orders to put up a barrage in conjunction with the artillery. There were rumors of a colossal German buildup on the other side, and which had our generals worried. The object of the barrage was to cover a raiding party of infantry, whose orders were to bring back a German prisoner, and so obtain from him some details as to what preparations for an attack were being made by the enemy. Our guns were laid on, and we took up positions after nightfall. The barrage was timed for 12:30 a.m. The raid was not a success. The infantry had not made contact with any German troops. But later, a prisoner was brought in. He had been badly hit and later died, but not before we had gained information from him that the attack we had been warned about was to take place early in the morning of the 27th of May. Field Marshal von Hindenburg refers to the capture of this German soldier in his book, Out of My Life. He says that this brave soldier did not give us any information. But subsequent events prove this not to be true, for it was on this information that our generals acted, and all units were put on alert, and we moved into our forward positions immediately on the side of the plateau facing the German line. Our company was a unit of the 50th Divisional Battalion of the Machine Gun Corps. To reach our forward position, we had to walk some distance along the trench, finally arriving at the gun emplacement. There are two gun teams at this point, each separated from the other by an underground passage, a sort of dugout. The gun positions were strengthened by a heavy timbered roof and covered with about 1 foot of earth. Not strong enough to withstand a direct hit, but safe from shrapnel and flying fragments of shells. Our gun was mounted in a position to fire through an aperture of about 18 inches square, cut out from the front of the trench. During the daytime, a sack covered the aperture, but we could pull the sack aside at any time to scan the enemy lines and so report any unusual movement. Our instructions were to fire on visible targets only. On the evening of the 27th of May, it was my turn to go on top at 11:30 p.m. All was quiet except for an odd shell coming over now and then, and neither did there appear to be any unusual movement. I was seated by the gun when a breathless runner arrived at our post and yelled out a message, "Stand to for gas," between 1 a.m. and 3 a.m. He disappeared quickly along the trench. Shortly afterwards, an officer arrived and, apparently in great haste, asked that the corporal report to company headquarters at once. It would be about 12:30 a.m. when the corporal left our post, and for some time after, all along the front was very quiet indeed. Then, at about 1 a.m., there was the terrific roar of artillery fire from the enemy lines, a barrage of an intensity such as I had never heard before. One historian states that this concentration of artillery fire was the heaviest of any action throughout the war. And I shall believe him, it was indeed terrible. The shells were pouring in, gas, HE, and machine gun fire. And in a very short time, our gun posts were completely hemmed in by the flying earth as the shells exploded all around us. And with the exception of the aperture through which we fired our gun, we were virtually prisoners in the emplacement. Our previous orders to fire on visible targets only had now to be ignored, and we trained our gun in the direction of the flashes coming from the enemy line. The barrage appeared to lift just before dawn, and straining our eyes in the half-light, we could see, to our amazement, the enemy observation balloons going up almost in our front line. A closer look, and we could see the German infantry pouring across no man's land towards our positions. And in what appeared to be only a matter of seconds, we could see through a gap in the earthwork the German infantry leaping across the top of our trench. There were masses of enemy troops about, and our position was beginning to look desperate. At the best, we were now prisoners of war. By this time, the other gun team had walked along the underground passage to join us. We held a conference as to what we should do. We thought it possible that our reserve forces would counterattack before nightfall, and when we should be released from this position and be back again with our unit. As we were discussing what move to make, a lighted candle was seen to be approaching the bottom of the dugout steps, right up to the gas curtain. We remained silent, and gradually the light of the candle receded. It was obvious that German troops had come in through the entrance formerly occupied by the number 2 gun team. Why they did not come up the steps to our position, I shall never know. We were certainly in a fix, and we had to get out somehow. And in preparation, we immobilized the Vickers guns by removing the lock. Without this, the gun was useless. Then, taking another look through the firing aperture, could be seen the German horse-drawn artillery right on our front line, within 20 or 30 yards of our position. We scratched our way out of the emplacement, and where we were completely hemmed in, the bursting shells had torn up the ground all around us. It was a miracle that we had escaped a direct hit, for the German artillery fire was accurate and concentrated on our front line. The morning was slightly misty, but one could see for quite a reasonable distance. As we crawled out, we were spotted by a German SM, who indicated that we assist the horses, haul the guns up the steep side of the plateau. He had a long whip, which he did not hesitate to use on two or three of our men. But in all fairness, I did not see anything more barbaric than this. As we stood around, a solitary shell from our own artillery exploded within 20 yards of our small group, but no one was hit. Looking across no man's land, could be seen many groups of prisoners, unescorted, making their way towards the former German front line and into captivity. It seemed so unreal to be walking on ground where, only an hour ago, sheer hell had rained down on the very spot we were now standing, every yard of which was pockmarked with shell holes and craters. We were then detailed to act as stretcher bearers to carry in the wounded. There were both British and German soldiers in need of attention. A number of our dead were lying where they had been killed. We paused to identify them, but their discs had already been removed. We helped to carry in a wounded German. He had a serious stomach wound and was delirious. Eventually, we reached a field hospital, and there we left this son of the fatherland. I felt very sorry for this poor fellow. Shortly afterwards, we tagged on to a long column of prisoners. Many were wounded, some seriously. But if they could stand, they had to walk. Our pace was of necessity slow, but eventually we arrived at the village of Ramicourt. Here we were put into a large cage, a cage being nothing more than a field surrounded by barbed wire and sentries to guard it. There we were split up into divisions by an interpreter. Our pay books were examined and then given back to us. A few questions were asked, but there did not seem to be anything of importance. The compound was packed with prisoners. One historian gives the figure of 28,000 taken on that day. A terrible catastrophe from our point of view. The numbers of killed and wounded were small when considered with the heavy losses on the Somme. But the loss of 28,000 men, before breakfast as it were, was fantastic. But so it was. No food was available to us on that day or the next. I doubt whether the Germans could cope. There were so many prisoners. Only a few of us had been able to hang on to our iron rations. We were getting very hungry. From then on, we were detailed in working parties and marched out daily to the section of the front where we had been captured. Here, we were put to work repairing roads and relaying a railway track. The work was very heavy indeed, and the food given to us was insufficient and of poor quality. Not enough to keep a man alive for very long, as things were to prove. But we had to get on with the job as best we could. The railway track would arrive in a sort of prefab condition, with the rails already attached to the sleepers. Our job was to manhandle the sections into position. It was heavy and dangerous work. We worked from early dawn to dusk, and were then marched back to the compound and given our daily ration of bread. A small loaf, about the size of our own small loaves, but this was for three men. The bread, we thought, was made from potato meal and probably a little flour added. We prisoners used to say it was 90% sawdust. We were also given a bowl of soup made from dehydrated vegetables, but no meat was served to us at all. On other occasions, it would be sauerkraut soup. But as hungry as we were, we found it a most revolting issue. Sauerkraut may be all right when served as a delicacy, but served in volume, as it was then, it was just horrible. It was the cause, too, of much diarrhea and dysentery amongst the prisoners, and daily we became weaker and weaker. We had long marches from the compound to the place of work. We started out at dawn and did not get back to the cage until late evening. Our only break was at midday for half an hour, with nothing to eat unless one had reserved a little bread from the previous night's ration, something it was almost impossible to do. The roads were inches deep in dust, and when a column of troops are on a road like that, you cannot see ahead for more than 20 or 30 yards. And when we arrived back to the camp, we looked just like snowmen, covered from head to foot in a layer of dust. Some weeks after our capture, a German officer came along and asked for volunteers to bury our dead. Three of our sergeants undertook this gruesome task. We were surprised that this last rite had been so long delayed. By this time, we were rapidly losing weight, and lice had taken a strong hold on our bodies. We had become so weak, we were unable to control our verminous condition. Washing facilities were almost non-existent, and our clothes were so filthy, it was impossible to deal with them. And now, big ulcer-like sores broke out on our bodies and legs. The lice had a bean feast. But we had to keep on working. There were no facilities for treating poorly prisoners there. And if one couldn't stand the pace, one just had to fade out and die. At all times, food was the main talking point. We would look back and think of the times we had complained about the food in our own training camps and in our own lines. But such food would be like a banquet here, and in the state we were now. By this time, we were seeking other sources of food supplies than that issued to us by the Germans, and which appeared to be getting less and less. We found in the early morning a snail-like creature stuck to the bark on the willow trees. We gathered these and also some nettle leaves, and on getting back to the camp at night, we would boil the snails, winkle them out of the shell with a pin, and chop them up with boiled nettle leaves, making a sort of paste to spread on our bread. I cannot say that the snails had any particular taste, but they did at least supplement our scanty rations in some small way. Occasionally, a troop train would halt in the sidings, and best we could, we would scamper along the line and beg for food from the German soldiers who were on their way to the front. I felt at times that these soldiers had some sympathy with our condition. Sometimes we would get a handout of a slice of bread or a cigarette. We found, too, that the soldiers wanted to buy or barter for almost any article of clothing, even braces. And anyone who was prepared to part with his boots would probably get a loaf of bread and 50 paper marks. The marks were useless where we were, but the loaf of bread was important. Towards the end of June, we were each given a postcard to fill in. It read, "I am sick, I am wounded, I am well." You crossed out the lines that did not apply and added your name, regiment and number. We knew it would be many weeks before the card reached home. There were transport difficulties and the card would have to be censored. We were now in the village of Vailey, only a short distance from where we had been captured. Here, there were dugouts on the hillside, and which gave us shelter at nights. A welcome change from sleeping in the field at Ramicourt, with only the sky for a blanket. We were still quite close to the front line, and each day the sound of artillery fire appeared to be getting nearer and nearer. We gathered from this that a big push from our own lines was underway. We even thought there could be a breakthrough, but at the moment it was not to be. As the days went by, we became weaker and weaker and were fast losing weight. When captured, I weighed 10 stones, but when I looked at my body as I was then, I thought I would scale between 6.5 and 7 stones only. It was now nearing the end of July, and as a workforce, we were almost useless. We were exhausted and emaciated. The Mecca, from a prisoners of war point of view, was to get into Germany. We knew of such places as Limburg and Gießen. There we had visions of mountains of food parcels awaiting us from England and from the British Red Cross base in Switzerland. One morning, I felt I was unable to stand on my feet. I was seen by a medical orderly who told me to stay in camp for the rest of the day. Some days later, a bunch of sick prisoners were got together, I amongst them. We were then put aboard a cattle truck train and hoped that we were on our way to hospital in Germany. The train halted at Ramikor, where we had been some time before. We'd retrained here and noticed that a large casualty clearing station had been set up near the railhead. We hung about the CCS for about a couple of days, being left to our own devices and without medical attention, of which we were sorely in need. At about 10 p.m. on the second day, we heard the familiar sound of approaching aircraft. They appeared to be circling the railhead. Then one of the planes dropped a marker, which lit up the surrounding area. Bombs quickly followed, and where they exploded on an ammunition dump. In a few minutes, the dump became an inferno. I was in a bell tent. Fragments of shells were flying in all directions. A large piece came through the canvas of my tent. I crawled out and took shelter behind a nearby tree. All through the night, the shells were exploding at the dump. I remained behind the tree until daybreak, when every available prisoner was mustered and ordered to the dump to help clear up the mess. The fire still raged, and one never knew which was the next shell to explode. During this clearing up operation, many of our men were hit by flying fragments of shells. It was late afternoon before the fire was brought under control, and the reckoning at the end of the day was there were many casualties, some of them very serious indeed. Next day, the sick prisoners were again mustered and put aboard a cattle truck train. It was not clear to us in which direction the train was traveling. The pace, too, was slow, and we were frequently shunted into a siding. It was obvious that the enemy transport system was going through a very difficult time. Late that night, we steamed into the station of Luxembourg. We knew now that we are near to the frontier and were heading for Germany. About 2 hours later, the train stopped at the old Roman town of Trier. There, a German medical officer came alongside the trucks and asked, "Are there any prisoners who feel they cannot travel any further?" I moved out with two Americans and two British soldiers. We were then taken to a large nearby building, which looked like a factory from the outside. Actually, it was a former barracks, but now being used as a hospital for prisoners of war. Here, we were stripped of our clothing and put into bed, the first real bed I had seen for many long weeks. Next morning, we were taken to a bathroom on a stretcher, but the water was only lukewarm, and our hair and body was alive with lice. More than a warm bath would be needed to get rid of that lot. We were so lousy. Later that morning, a German hospital sister came to see us. She spoke no English, but just looked down at each one of us. She shook her head and said something about Krieg, one German word with which we were familiar. Sister was a lady of some 30 years of age, and in the weeks that followed, I was to get to know her well. She was a dedicated nurse and a credit to the nursing profession. We knew her as Schwester Christina. Nationality and war had no place in her thoughts. All she wanted to do was to get the men well, although she was greatly hampered by the shortage of food and of the facilities that one expects in any hospital. In our ward, there were many nationalities: French, Italian, Russian, Polish, and we British, all of whom were in an emaciated condition and suffering from diarrhea and dysentery. By this time, I had acquired a sufficient vocabulary in German to be able to string a few simple sentences together. And in some way, I could do a little interpreting for Schwester when she entered the ward. I would explain in my own way, and she seemed to understand. Each evening, before going off duty, Schwester would call up the ward with a jug of water and would say, "Wasser trinken?" She was no linguist, but she had acquired the goodnight greeting of the different nationalities in her ward. And as she left the room, she would say, "Bonsoir, Franzos. Buonasera, Italiano. Spagoninite, Siruski. And good night, Englander." We would then return the greeting in German. About 3 weeks after being brought to the hospital, one of the men who came off the train with me died. Like many more, he had failed to make a recovery. The months of starvation behind the line were more than the body could stand. I was fortunate. I was getting better. Some weeks later, I became strong enough to get out of bed and walk along the passages. I met a number of Russians, but although conversation was difficult, we got on quite well. Their news trickling through was not good. The word Bolshevik could be frequently heard in their conversation. It was obvious that an uncertain future lay before them. After 12 weeks in hospital, I was considered well enough to be moved to one of the large prison camps. During the 3 months I had spent here, I had regained a little weight, but I still scaled only 8 stones, 2 stones below my normal weight. Even in the hospital, the food ration was totally inadequate. Our blockade on the high seas had put a stranglehold on Germany, and she was near to the point of starvation. On the morning that I was to leave the hospital, the German orderly, with his raus, raus call, had me up at 6 a.m. and gave me instructions to report to the office. This I did, along with 2 other French soldiers. Here we were to await the escort guard, or Posten, as it is said in German. For 2 hours we waited there, but there was no sign of the Posten, who was to take us to Gießen. At this juncture, the sergeant instructed us to go back to the ward and await a call from there. During the waiting time which I had spent in that office, I began to feel quite ill, and getting back to the ward, I got into bed again. About mid-afternoon, the orderly came into the room and raved about me being in bed. I muttered the German word for ill. "Krank," I said, whereupon he took out a thermometer and thrust it under my arm and took the reading. "38°," he said. "Grippe." I was a victim of the flu epidemic that was scything its way across Europe and through Germany in particular. 1 week later, I got out of bed, and the very next day I was picked up by the Posten and transported to the prisoner of war camp in Gießen. About this time, there were rumors that Germany was seeking an armistice, and as the days went by, we noticed that the guards were not so strict in carrying out their duties. In fact, some of our men jumped camp and ventured into the town without being challenged by anyone. This was understandable, for prisoners were leaving their jobs in the mines and the factories and making their own way back to the camp, bringing in the news that an armistice had been signed. The civilian population had the news too, and they besieged the camp, clambering up the posts in search of food, bringing with them large-style German wooden pipes as a means of barter. These pipes were sought after by our men as souvenirs. Within a few days, preparations were in hand for our repatriation, and what a thrill it was to march out of camp, to feel almost free again. On the way to the station, we sang heartily from our repertoire of war songs. I was still very weak, not having fully recovered from the attack of the grip. But as I was on my way home, I could not have wished for a better tonic. Thousands of our men had died in captivity, mostly through neglect and starvation. Leaving Gießen, our train went along at a slow pace, and hold-ups and shuntings into sidings were very frequent. To my surprise and delight, perhaps, the train halted at Trier. Due to the kind treatment I had received in hospital there, I had an inner feeling of some attachment to the town, a feeling that has remained with me throughout my life. There were rumors that our train was heading for Metz in Lorraine, Between Trier and Metz, we saw fragments of the German army in retreat. Small groups, still carrying rifles, walking back to the fatherland. Once we saw a whole company, headed by an officer, marching back in true military fashion. And another group, manhandling a light piece of artillery. They looked weary and worn out, but here was evidence that their morale had not entirely broken down. Although there were many small groups and stragglers making their way homewards. We detrained in Metz and were met by an officer and an artillery sergeant. The Allies had not yet fully occupied the city. After 3 days in Metz, we again entrained, and after what seemed an endless journey, we arrived in Boulogne. Here, we were greeted by nurses and officials of the British Red Cross Society, and within 2 hours, we had been deloused in a steam bath, fitted out with new clothing, and were sitting down to a good meal. The next day, we were in Dover. 2 days later, I was home. When I left the hospital in Trier, I promised myself that when I got back home, I would write to Schwester Christina and thank her for all her kindness in getting me well again. It is with much regret and perhaps some sadness I never did. But that is not quite the end of the story. For in the December of 1975, I wrote to the Burgermeister of Trier and mentioned my stay there in hospital as a prisoner of war in 1918, and of the good treatment I had received from a German hospital sister, whom I only knew by the name of Schwester Christina. That was the only information I could give to the Burgermeister. However, within a few days, I had a reply which said that my letter was to be published in the local newspaper, and an appeal would be made over the local radio to endeavor find a relative or someone who had known the nurse. Within 2 weeks, I had a letter from the publisher of the newspaper informing me that the family had been traced. The information was that the nurse's name was Christina Loser. Enclosed with the letter was a tattered old photograph, which I instantly recognized as that of the Schwester who looked after me so well. It seemed so incredible that after a lapse of over 50 years, I had made contact with the family. And so, on this note, I will close the book. The Machine Gun Corps was formed in 1915. The headquarters were at Belton Park, Grantham. The total enlistment in the Corps was 11,500 officers and 151,900 other ranks. Officers killed in action, 1,120. Other ranks, 12,671. Officers wounded and missing, 2,881. Other ranks, missing and prisoners of war, 45,377. The above figures are those shown on the Boy David Machine Gun Corps Memorial in Hyde Park, London. The regiment was disbanded at Shorncliffe on the 15th of July, 1922.